You're listening to MLB.com Extras, brought to you by MLB.tv. It's baseball everywhere.
On this week's tour around the NL Central, the retirement of Prince Fielder hitting hard for many people in the Milwaukee Brewers organization. An accordion somehow finds its way into the Pirates clubhouse, courtesy of Starling Marte. And your bold prediction for the day, the Chicago Cubs will lose another baseball game between now and 2017. We kick things off this week with our Brewers reporter, Adam McKelvey. Adam, thank you so much for the time. And as we discuss things right now at this current moment, the Brewers are putting a beating on the Braves 10-3 in the bottom of the seventh. A good start for Matt Garza. And the Brewers, as we pointed out before we got going here on the air, have scored in every inning of this game. They are 7-for-7 in terms of scoring in an inning. So assuming they do not bat in the ninth, which they should not, maybe they can pull this off and score in the eighth to set some kind of record. We don't know the last time a team did that. You know, that's for the folks at Elias to figure out. But we'll see what transpires in these next 10 to 12 minutes and see if the Brewers can do something kind of cool and score in every inning of a game. Right now they're leading 10-3. But Adam, again, as we pointed out before we hit the record button, we want to start off today by talking about a guy who does not play for the Brewers and a guy who is not even in the same league as the Brewers. That, of course, is Prince Fielder. And he was such a big part of this team, of this franchise, for so many years. And he spent the first seven seasons of his career in Milwaukee, drafted by the franchise in 2002, the seventh overall pick. And, of course, the very untimely and heartbreaking, really, announcement of the end of his career after a second serious neck surgery. And Adam, it goes without saying, I'll say it anyway, put up some monster numbers in a Brewers uniform for so many years, and I got to think that there was a lot of reaction, a lot of reflection too, within the Brewers organization about Fielder after he announced again his very untimely ending of his big league career.
Yeah, there was. Okay, so, you know, this is tricky because the Brewers came to prominence just as Prince Fielder was getting to the big leagues, and it was a group of guys who brought them to prominence. It was Ricky Weeks and Prince Fielder and Corey Hart, J.J. Hardy, later Ryan Braun, guys who were drafted and developed by the Brewers. In Doug Melvin's view, he said this when Prince signed with Detroit and sort of officially left the Brewers organization. To Doug Melvin, the GM at the time, Prince was the guy of that group. And in that sense, he kind of had a special place, I think, in the history of this franchise as they overcame years of being also-rans and really got to the point where they expected to do something. A lot of that came from Prince Fielder being, number one, a really good player, a huge run producer in the middle of the lineup, 50 homers, got the top two home run seasons in Brewers history, the top OPS season in Brewers history. But then there was also kind of this Prince Fielder attitude that he carried where he was kind of a badass, and he was kind of a guy that other teams didn't want to mess with, and you know, and that kind of bled, I think, into a lot of the other players. He made everybody a little bit tougher and a little bit better. So in all those different ways, he was a huge part of this franchise's history, and there was a lot of sadness, I think, here to see it end the way he did for him. He was a guy who played every inning of every game one season for the Brewers. He played 162 twice. He had a long games played streak that ended when he was literally getting IVs in the training room in Houston, and he was lobbying to play. This guy was an Iron Man, and to see him cut down by injury is odd and very sad, I think, for a lot of the people who knew him.
Yeah, and you mentioned that swagger that he carried and that carried over to his teammates. I mean, let's face it. I mean, the guy, first of all, the guy's name is Prince. So right then and there, you're going to draw a lot of attention just for that. Second of all, he's the son of Cecil Fielder, himself a prominent slugger in his heyday. And the one stat that I think everybody is just blown away by is that Prince Fielder retires with the exact same number of home runs as his dad, which is just unthinkable. They each have 319. Yeah. That's just crazy. So I don't think – yeah, go ahead, Adam.
Well, I was going to say that is crazy. And, you know, it's been a while since I've talked to Prince about all that stuff. I would imagine that's not a positive thing for him. You know, he was driven to a large degree by outdoing his dad. They had a very famous falling out. It's one of the saddest stories I've ever covered in baseball, from how close they were when Prince signed with the Brewers to having a terrible falling out over money and betrayal. And it was awful. And it changed Prince Fielder. He became very closed off a lot of times publicly, and we didn't really get inside with him. We didn't get to hear what he really thought about baseball and Craig Counsell said he was a very deep baseball thinker. We never got much of that. He was distrustful of people, I think, except for his very small circle. And it was sad. And I think a lot of that came from the fact that he was driven to outdo what his father accomplished in the game. So to end on that same homer, that same home run total, it's very coincidental. And it makes me sad, honestly. I wish he had one more.
Yeah, I think a lot of people do, because as you pointed out, you know, for so long, that relationship and that bond between Cecil and his son was so tight-knit, so close, and we saw so many, you know, pictures when Cecil was hitting home runs for the Tigers for so many years. So, you know, there's Prince, and I don't want to say a little guy, but a big little guy, you know, Following his dad around in the batting cages and taking some BP of his own, and then to see it go from that to this, where they've had this terrible falling out, and they don't communicate anymore by all records. It really is sad, as you said, and again, the cruel irony that for a guy like Prince to be as driven as he was to outdo his dad, he retires with the exact same number of home runs. Maybe he's got him in home runs per at-bats. Did he do it in fewer games? I'm not aware, are you?
No, more games. More games.
More games,
but he
okay.
had more RBIs.
There we
and
go.
We're not supposed to care about RBIs anymore because we're all more statistically advanced than that. But I don't care. I'm going to point to the RBI total.
Yeah, I will too. So, you know what? At the end of the day, more RBIs. Who cares how many games it took? Who cares if that's an outdated stat? Prince has got his dad in that category. And, Adam, as you pointed out, prior, I find it so kind of cruelly ironic, too, that obviously for so many years the discussion about Prince Fielder was about the weight and how he carried too many LBs on that frame and how eventually it was going to slow him down. Well, looking at his baseball reference page, I think for a five-year stretch between 2009 and 2013, he missed one game. Guys miss one game in 2 weeks now, and people don't blink. He missed one game in 5 years. The weight was never an issue in that regard. And it's not the weight that ends his career. It's something completely unrelated to weight or being in shape or physique. And, you know, I just found it amazing that people don't really consider Prince Fielder, you know, an athlete in the traditional mold because he didn't have that body. But he had that frame to carry that weight, and he was one of the most, if not the most durable guy during his heyday of any player in baseball.
Yeah, and I'll tell you, that's when I talked to Bob Uecker about Prince. Those guys were really, really close, by the way. Uecker says that's what he'll remember is the durability, and he told a story about he was doing the Ken Maka show when Maka was the manager, and on the side, Ken Maka mentions to him that he's going to give Prince a day off, and Uecker just looked at him and smiled and said, "Are you kidding me?" And Maka said, "No, I want to give him a day off." And you looked at him and said, "You know, Kenny, that's not going to happen." And Maka says, "Well, what do you mean? I'm the manager. If I'm going to give him a day off, I'm going to do it." And Uecker says, "I'm sorry, that's just not going to happen." And sure enough, Prince Fielder won that particular battle and was in the lineup. And the day that game you're talking about where he missed, it was in Houston, and he was literally so sick that he had to get IV. From the Astros team doctor, and yet he was still lobbying to play. They had to basically carry him back to the team hotel to get rest that night. So, he was durable. He played every day, and he ran to first base really hard, and he was complicated. He was not a baseball saint. I'm not trying to make him out to be that way, but you could never question how bad that guy wanted to win, and you could just watch it yesterday how much it killed him to have to step away.
Mark, unfortunately, I got to start on a down note because the game on Monday night, it looked like it was going to be the first career win for Cody Reed in his ninth attempt at it. The poor kid sees a 4-0 lead slip away in the bottom of the ninth in St. Louis. The Cardinals, a stunning 5-run rally to turn a 4-0 deficit into a 5-4 win. And now Cody Reed, 6-score this inning, is all for naught. He is still winless in his big league career in 9 starts. But Mark, I want to start off on the bullpen that night, which has been much improved, especially in the last month or two, with guys like Cingrani picking things up, and Raisel Iglesias has been just silly good since he came back, and he's been put into the bullpen. But that night, it was Cingrani and Ross Ohlendorf who got beat up. Ohlendorf eventually gives up the walk-off hit by pitch, of all things, to Yadier Molina. But Iglesias did not pitch in that ninth, and I kind of wondered why at the time. He had thrown over 30 pitches the day before, kind of a not-so-sharp outing for him. Believed he walked three, gave up a run in one inning of work. Was he completely unavailable that night? Was he a guy that Brian Price wanted to stay away from no matter what?
Yeah, generally, when Iglesias pitches a lot in a game, whether it's one inning or with a lot of pitches, like 30-plus pitches, where he has a two-inning appearance or even a three-inning appearance, the likelihood is almost 100% that he will not pitch the next day. They're still using special protocol with him that they don't use with other relievers, just because he came back from two shoulder injuries in the last calendar year, including one this season that put him on the DL for 6 weeks. And they're still treating him with special circumstances, and that makes him different than what would be, he'd be the ideal closer for this team if he could work 3 days in a row or even 2 days in a row. And right now he's not in that position. He's been so stellar. He's got like a 0.59 ERA since June 21st when he came back. And all signs are pointing that he could be their future closer. But right now he can't take on closer duties because he doesn't have closer endurance, and the gloves are not completely off for him. So they'll work through it. And eventually I would say him and Michael Lorenzen will be a potent late inning combination more regularly when they feel like Iglesias is ready to do that.
Yeah, I mean, I would imagine it was tough for Brian Price on Monday night to see this thing slipping away and to see Cody Reed, who had all these hopes of getting that first big league win, he's on the bench and he can't do anything to get this thing from spiraling out of control. You got to think that he was very tempted to use Iglesias in that spot, but again, you look at the big term, the long-term picture, and he stays away from Iglesias, and the ball game ends not the way the Reds wanted it to, obviously, as the Cardinals win it 5-4. But you brought up, not just Iglesias, but Michael Lorenzen as well. I think that, the Reds knew what they had in Iglesias. The guy just has an electric arm, all the potential in the world. I know that, Michael Lorenzen, also very highly touted, maybe not to the level of an Iglesias, but have they been even a little pleasantly surprised at just how good he's performed?
I wouldn't say pleasantly surprised. I think it's just a different role. He was a college closer, and they took him with the 1A pick in the draft, I think, a couple of years ago, and they identified him as a starter, and they went to that, developed him as a starter, and he had some promising starts. He had some struggles as well, but then he came back up from the struggles at the end of last season, and he worked out of the bullpen, and he showed some gas that he could throw 98 and be effective, and had definitely had his edge back. And then, of course, they wanted to make him a starter again going into 2016, and then trouble happened. He got to one game, he got an elbow inflammation, then he had to sit out for a while, then he got mono and lost 25-plus pounds, and lost any hope of maybe starting the season. If they had started, he may not even be back yet. So they would have had to get him and build him back up again. So they kind of took a shortcut and realized that in order to get anything out of him this season to be effective, that would be have to be out of the bullpen, and they could reevaluate after the season. And he's just been very good out of the bullpen in general. He's got power stuff, and it's moving pretty well for the most part. He just seems like he's just on point. And in terms of the bullpen, between him and Iglesias, it's been uplifting for them. I mean, Singani's been better other than the other day, and Blake Wood's been much better. He's been pretty solid overall, but having those two guys really added stability that wasn't there in the first half.
Maybe another Aroldis Chapman will never come around. Those guys are, they're maybe once in a generation type pitchers, but moving forward, if you can have a 1-2 back end combo of Lorenzen and Iglesias, that's got to be very exciting for the Reds and for their fan base too. Mark, I want to circle back around to Cody Reed. I know you haven't spoken to him recently, but knowing him as you do, and knowing him and knowing the struggles he's gone through, and he's received a lot of encouragement, as we've talked about in previous weeks, from the management, from his veteran teammates. How tough do you think it was for him to know that he was so close to getting big league win number one? And I know that, in this day and age, wins aren't everything. It's an overrated stat. Nonetheless, when you're a young kid and you still got that goose egg in the win column, I would think that's got to be hard. How do you think he's handling going, 0-9, at least in terms of getting that first big league win?
Well, I can tell you that before when I last saw him and he struggled, each interview post game was getting shorter and shorter because he's getting more and more frustrated. At first, it was kind of just chalking it up. He's happy to be there. He got the nerves, but overall, You know, it's a learning experience. And after three or four of those, it stopped being a learning experience, and it just was just frustration. And you could tell that he was not enjoying the outcomes at all. He did have that one decent start where he deserved better, but he started out rough and kind of slowed his pace down, and then was really encouraged by his last three or four innings, and that showed he was pretty happy about that. I would imagine he wants the major league win, of course. I mean, even though the win stat's been discounted, pitchers still chase wins, so I'm sure he wants it. But I have to think that just going out and throwing six scoreless innings had to be very uplifting and very encouraging for him, because he's been getting his butt kicked up and down the league and being hit hard. He's just not losing games. He's getting clobbered. And I think that was obviously frustrating because he hasn't gone through that at all, probably in his entire life. So I think just getting out there and being not just competitive but strong was probably very, very good for him. And the win will come. If he keeps pitching like that, it's going to happen. It's not going to always be lost by the bullpen. One of these days he's going to put it together, and the offense and the bullpen are going to pick him up, and he's going to get that major league win and savor that and keep the ball and all that good stuff.
Carry the Cubs once again, the hottest team in baseball after Sunday's win. They've won seven straight. They've kind of reaffirmed their status, I think, as the clear-cut most dominant team in the major leagues. And, Kerry, I think that right now you can kind of break up this Cubs season in three parts. They had that blazing start. They came roaring out of the gate, eventually went to 27 games over 500 at 47-20. Then a bit of a lull. They lost 15-20. Some things got out of whack. Some guys got hurt, Dexter Fowler chief among them. He's back, he's healthy, and not coincidentally, the club is playing much better. As I said, they've won seven straight, and now they're at their high water mark of the season, as we discuss things on this Monday, at 69-41. So kind of compare and contrast, when you look at the Cubs right now and you look at the Cubs at the beginning part of the season, would you say that the Cubs, if not a more dominant team, a more complete team than they were at the onset of the season?
Well, I don't know if I'd say more dominant. I just think that guys have a better feel for what they can do. And it always seems to come back to Dexter. Fowler, you go, we go, Fowler's the guy. And if he's doing well, the whole offense seems to do well. And it's they just really need to keep him in the lineup. And the other guy, I think that maybe sort of goes unnoticed, that's done a really nice job and contributed, is Javier Baez. He's been hitting like 300 since the end of June and subbing everywhere, which is part of Joe Maddon's little plan to give guys a break. And Javier steps in and seems to be sort of a secret weapon that they have. So he's not to be overlooked either. But it always seems to come back to Dexter. I mean, Dexter he's right now he's sixth in the National League on base percentage. He scored 11 runs in his last eight games. I mean, he's, when he gets on, everything else seems to just boom, go. And it's propelled the team.
And it's amazing. Well. Yeah, absolutely. And it's amazing to think that, this was kind of a last-minute re-signing by the Cubs in the offseason. We remember that great seed in spring training where Joe Maddon gathered his guys around, and then, hey, guess who showed up? Guess who's back? Dexter Fowler comes walking in, gets a big round of applause, and he's been so instrumental to this team and the success they've had this year, as they should be the first team to 70 wins. Off day here today on Monday. They host the Angels Tuesday. We'll get to that in a little bit. But, Kerry, going back to the series in Oakland this past weekend, of course, they sweep. They've won seven straight, and a big weekend in particular for Jorge Soler, his first three games since coming off the DL. He goes 4-for-12. Three of the four hits, extra bases, including two home runs, also had a double. He drove in five. He's been terrific. Now, of course, because they play the A's in Oakland, an American League ballpark, Joe Maddon had the luxury of DHing Soler. That's obviously not going to be an option when the team returns to Wrigley. So when he presumably returns to the outfield, what kind of a domino effect is that going to have, Kerry?
I can see Soler just being plugged into left field. I also think that they'll be very careful with him because they don't want him to re-aggravate the hamstring. So he probably won't be an everyday player. And again, going back to Maddon's theory that in August he wants to make sure guys get a breather every once in a while. So I could see, he could start Soler in left. He can start Bryant in left. He could put Soler in right field. to give Hayward a breather. So it's going to be just one more really nice piece. It's really good to see Soler come back healthy and strong, getting a hit in every one of the games in Oakland. To get two home runs during that series is nice. You know, comes through with five RBI. I mean, that's huge for him, and it's huge for the team just to know that he's healthy and that he can contribute.
Yeah, I mean, if you can add him to the, you know, that two-headed monster you've already got in the middle of that order with Rizzo and Bryant, I mean, you know, look out. There's going to be nowhere to hide for opposing pitchers. So far, so good for Jorge Soler. And as you said, you know, Joe Maddon will likely plug him into left. And a guy that's been in left field in recent weeks, really, has been Wilson Contreras. And kind of a quiet day Sunday, 0-for-4, 2 Ks. But he was on the receiving end of yet another dominant outing from Kyle Hendricks. He's just been sensational and just named the NL Player of the Week on this Monday. So what Contreras did in that regard should not be overlooked. Now, what's interesting is he's made 18 starts, both behind the plate and in the outfield, a 50-50 split. And, you know, nowadays I know there's more positional versatility in the game, but that's kind of unheard of. And I know that the Cubs knew about his athleticism and his versatility because obviously they know the guy well. They scouted him for years, and that certainly was not a secret. But the way that he's contributed defensively with that versatility at such a young age, not having any exposure to the major leagues before a month or two ago, has that even surprised the Cubs just how good he's been?
Probably not, because I don't think they would have called him up unless if they thought that it was going to be a real big struggle. They like his bat so much that that's one of the reasons that they put him out in left field. You know, when he was first promoted in June, the plan was so that he would be mentored by Miguel Montero and David Ross. So I guess the way I see it is that he's took to that so well and he's done so well behind the plate when he's had some games that they just they figure, well, let's go, because this is a bat that you really want in your lineup if you are going to get into the postseason. You know, Wilson can really contribute in a lot of ways. He can throw, you know, he can stop the running game better than Ross and Montero can. He can, you know, he's really good defensively in terms of blocking pitches. The nice thing to me is that after every one of the games that Wilson catches, the starting pitcher always makes a point of saying how much better Contreras has gotten and how they can see it. There was a game with Hamill where Hamill was saying that just looking at Wilson, that, you know, they were able to communicate that way, and boom, you know, they're on the same page the whole time. And that's really nice to see that he's developing as a catcher, which was the plan.
Yeah, and I think a lot of fans in general kind of overlook how much work day in and day out is required of catchers to learn your pitcher, to learn your pitching staff, how to call a game, how to do it effectively, play defense the whole bit, and you got to swing the bat too. So there's a lot on these guys' shoulders, and for a guy that young to handle all this as well as he has, I mean, it's no wonder that he was a can't-miss prospect, and he should be a benefit and a boon to the Cubs for many, many years to come. Kerry, switching gears a little bit, we talked about reliever Joe Smith last week and about the funk, as Joe Maddon likes to call it, that he brings to the bullpen. You've got so many guys that just throw straight gas, and in comes Joe Smith, kind of that three-quarters delivery, and he just presents a different look. But you had an interesting article on something I was not aware of, and maybe most fans weren't as well. His mother is actually very ill, and she resides in Cincinnati, and he was quoted as saying to you that, you know, it's obviously a tough situation, but professionally it's almost ideal to get traded where he did, because now instead of a five-hour flight, as he said, it's a five-hour drive between himself and his mother. And I got to think that, again, you know, it is a tough situation, but all things considered, this is the best possible scenario considering his personal situation.
Well, I'm sure that for him the best possible scenario might be to be traded to Cincinnati so he could be home to be around her. But this is probably just as well. Joe was saying that he was hoping to get his mother to a game at Wrigley if possible. She's battling Huntington's disease. There's no cure for it. It's just a really debilitating disease with several combinations of things, and, you know, in terms of dementia and things that she's got to go with. She might not even know where her son is pitching right now, to be perfectly honest. But it's you know, he's trying to make the best of it, and it was nice to be around him and hear him talk about it because he had a really positive attitude, and it's just see what happens. I know the Cubs have a good homestand coming up, and he was going to try and get her up here for that.
To be blunt, it's not been good lately for the men in red. We talked last week about this upcoming six-game stretch against the Reds and the Braves, and no offense to either team, but you look at that schedule, you think, you know, we're going to take at least four out of five of these games against two of the lower-running teams in baseball. But the six-game stretch ends, only two wins out of those six, and alas, what was once a nine-game deficit is now 11.5 as they've really fallen off the pace behind the Cubs in the Central. And, Jen, I don't know if this is the worst stretch of baseball the Cardinals have played this year, but is it the most disappointing considering who the opponents were?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's why it stands out. I mean, we've seen this team play very ragged baseball all year. We see them get on what we think will be some sort of roll, and then they kind of teeter back and see a kind of a dud of a game. And so they've been very uneven all year, but I think when you look at the schedule and an opportunity that they had in front of them to play nine games against the Reds and Braves, what better opportunity to help you maybe stay in the NL Central race, which now is, I don't think, any longer a race, but certainly in the wild card race. So to see them drop 2-3 in Cincinnati and then to come home where they continue to play poorly and there's really no explanation that anybody can come up with. But this team is 26-32 at Busch Stadium, a place where they won 55 games a year ago. So that continues to be perplexing. And to lose 2-3 to the Braves, who have essentially mailed it in on this season, I don't know, maybe mailed it in on next season or are playing for 2018, that's a real disappointment for a team that thinks it belongs in the wild card hunt. So, you know, just as we thought they were gaining traction with that series win in New York, the win in those first two games in Miami, then you look since then, they've lost 6-8 and lost a ton of ground to the Cubs, who at the same time the Cardinals are faltering, they're playing some of their best baseball.
And, Jen, I know that, you know, Cardinals fans have a well-deserved reputation of being very supportive and, you know, always behind their team, no matter what, the good times and the bad. But you just brought up the sub-500 record at Busch Stadium this season, which is so rare for the Cardinals, especially in recent years. Are you starting to, if not hear boo birds in the stands, are you starting to sense some real discontent amongst the fan base at home, which we clearly have not seen in recent years?
Yeah, I mean, I hear them on Twitter. I get them in my email. I hear them on the sports talk radio stations in town. There is a lot of frustration. And I mean, that goes to the point that the Cardinals have set such a high standard here, such high expectations that kind of anything short of perfection is there's going to be grumblings about. But this year in particular, the lack of wins at home, I mean, this team is continuing to draw very, very well. They're going to draw 3.5 million fans again. They haven't had a game this year in which they've drawn fewer than 40,000. So fans are still coming out. And again, they're coming out to watch a team that is very much in the thick of a wild card race, but they're also watching a team that's been very frustrating. And I think seeing the pitching kind of regress from where it was last year, seeing the defense be as poor as it has been, seeing the Cardinals run into so many outs on the bases and just making some dumb base running decisions, all of that combined, it's just not Cardinal baseball. And the fans here have been very spoiled, and I think they would tell you and acknowledge as much. They've been very spoiled here to see a lot of good baseball over the last decade and a half. And, you know, even when the team hasn't always been winning, they've usually been playing very fundamentally sound. And for whatever reason, this club has just not been able to put that together this year.
Yeah, and I think it's, you know, it's unfair to expect another 100-win campaign like the Cardinals had in 2015. That's just, you know, that's unrealistic. But again, as you said, it's not just the L's, it's the way those L's are coming, like you said, with the dumb base running decisions and the poor fundamentals and the poor execution. That's what's really sticking in the craw of the Cardinal fan base right now and the reason for the discontent among the fan base. Jen, let's talk about Adam Wainwright. He might have had his most frustrating start of the season yesterday. He was on such a good roll, I think unbeaten in six or seven straight starts, definitely unbeaten in the month of July. You know, the numbers say he gave up six runs in two innings, but you take a closer look, as you wrote, he could have very easily had a 1-2-3 11-pitch first inning. That did not happen. A couple of calls did not go his way. A couple of balls that just missed infielder's gloves, they trickled through for hits and RBI hits, and next thing you know, it's the third inning and you're down 6-0. So, you know, even though Wainwright is the definition of a pro and a seasoned veteran and a guy that can put, you know, misfortune and bad luck behind him, did you sense that even he got a little bit frustrated with the things that did not go his way yesterday?
Yeah, you know, it was funny. One of the things he said post-game is sometimes you do need luck to go your way. I mean, as skillful as you can be and as much, you know, on top of your craft as you are, sometimes you do need things to fall your way. And, you know, in many ways, it was kind of a microcosm of this season, what we saw yesterday, in that they feel like they're so close to putting it all together, and yet little things happen here and there that knock everything out of whack. I mean, as you mentioned, I mean, Wainwright gets the first two hitters of the game on six pitches, thinks he has Freddie Freeman, the three-hole hitter for the Braves, struck out at two different points. He doesn't. Freddie Freeman walks. And then we see the next hitter hit a fly ball to right center that the Cardinals had any speed in their outfield. Probably an outfielder would have gotten to it. It drops for a double. The next ball is hit up the middle, a ball that Wainwright afterwards said he should be able to get a glove on. Instead, it becomes a two-run single. So all these little things just snowballed. And as you mentioned, you know, two innings into the game, 61 pitches, and it's 6-0 Atlanta. So credit to Adam that he was able from there to rebound and give this club six innings. One of the things that's really plagued this team since the All-Star break is the number of short starts that they've had. I mean, their pitchers haven't been consistently getting past the fifth inning. So he did at least save the bullpen to some degree. He was at least able to end it on somewhat of a positive note. But when you put your team in a six-run deficit, even against the Braves, it's a mighty hole to crawl out of.
Yeah, it sure is. And for as many games as you watch over so many years, it's amazing how so many times, you know, a game comes down to you know, one pitch, one call, one inch left or right. You know, it just makes such a big difference, and it did yesterday, unfortunately, on the negative side of things for Adam Wainwright and the Cardinals and losing to the Braves 6-3 and dropping the rubber game of that series. Jen, going back one night prior to Saturday, both Matt Carpenter and Yadi Molina depart that game due to injury. Now, we saw Yadi back yesterday, but not the case with Carpenter. Are we looking at another setback here for Matt, or is Mike Matheny just being a little extra cautious considering how banged up he has been lately?
Yeah, this was a precautionary move. We saw Matt Carpenter return on Friday, and he looked good. I went 0-for-4 at the plate, but he looked like he was following through with his swings and seemed very comfortable. And then for whatever reason on Saturday, just appeared hesitant and apprehensive both in the field and at the plate. And after the Cardinals watched him take his fifth inning at bat, where it just didn't look like he trusted himself to swing all the way through, decided it was time to pull him out, wanted to give his oblique kind of another examination to make sure everything had healed. The good news in that is that medically he is fine. So now it's just a matter of how long it's going to take Matt Carpenter to trust that he is fine. Now the Cardinals were going to give him Sunday off regardless, even if he had gone 4-for-4 on Saturday as part of kind of their protocol and how they wanted to bring him back from the injury. So he's back in the lineup on Monday. He is 0-for-6 so far since coming off the DL. As I mentioned, also has had some trouble in the field, but if he can trust himself and trust that he is not going to re-aggravate that injury, I think he'll be okay. I mean, medically, this is no longer an issue. And for the Cardinals, whose offense has lagged a little bit here since Lednicias went on the DL earlier, I guess at the very end of July, they need Matt Carpenter. They need him to be the leadoff hitter that he was when he got hurt. So often we've seen before, as he goes, so does this offense.
Adam, we thank you as always for the time. And let's just kind of start off in general terms with this Pirates team and the team's last 20 games. They're only 10-10 and not playing the best competition in that 20-game stretch. And again, just a 500 mark in those 20 games. And, you know, as of this discussion right now on Friday, they're only two games out of the second wild card spot. But to me, and I don't know if you agree, this just kind of feels like a team in some regards that's really treading water instead of a team that's really in the heat of a playoff chase. Like, I mean, am I off base here, or does this kind of feel the same to you and to maybe some of the fans too?
I think definitely the fans, I would agree with that completely. You mentioned that 20-game stretch. They went 10-10 against the Brewers, Phillies, Mariners, who are turning around a little bit, the Brewers again, the Braves, Reds, and Padres. None of those teams are what you would call, you know, really difficult competition, aside from the fact that they're just major league teams and every major league team can win on any given night. But it has felt a little weird, and it's hard to explain because, you know, they are struggling as a team in many different ways. You know, the lineup has not looked very good. The rotation has actually turned it around quite a bit since they made some of these changes here recently. But overall, the record just doesn't really reflect the team that's in the playoff chase. However, nobody else in the running for that second wild card has really sort of run ahead and claimed it. I mean, you know, the Marlins at this point are kind of in the driver's seat on that front. The Cardinals are dealing with some injuries now. They're probably having a very similar sounding season, I would imagine, if you talk to Brian Langosh about it. And, you know, then you have the Pirates and the Mets who are in a very similar situation, just kind of, you know, falling, treading water, you know, not really making a strong push to get it much ahead of 500. So they're kind of in a weird place overall. But, you know, if you sort of take a step back and if you're just looking at the standings and not watching the team play every day, you would think two games out of a wild card, you know, with the better part of, you know, a month and a half, 2 months to go, this team still has a chance if they can get something sort of falling in place the way that they planned.
And what I find interesting, too, is that, of course, you know, you talk to any Pirates fan and they'll tell you how much they, you know, they hate the wild card spot because of the wild card game and the way that's gone for the Pirates in the last two seasons. It's been one and done. They won in their first appearance 3 years ago. Mm-hmm. But again, the last two have not gone the Pirates' way. So here they come into the season, you know, knowing that we have a good enough team, we can compete, as they always do, for the NL Central crown. But because the Cubs are just destroying everything in their path, and I believe their division lead is like, I don't know, 13, 14 games. As of right now, they're destroying the Cardinals today as we speak. Is that a part of it where there's some lingering disappointment that, you know what, if we do get into the playoffs again, it's going to, again, be as a wild card, and that's why this doesn't really feel as intense or joyful as it has the past couple seasons?
I think the reason for that is more just based on the performance. You know, you look in, even if you do consider the games behind, you know, that they are for the wild card spot, the performance just hasn't been that good. I mean, they're two games at 500. It seems like they haven't really broken much past that over the last several weeks. You know, they've been going 500 essentially for the better part of a month now. I think that's more the reason that it doesn't feel quite as inspired as the last couple of years, because honestly, the way that sort of expectations change over time, the way that this team struggled through June, I think just making the postseason and having a chance would be a good thing for this team. And you mentioned that second wild card. It's something the Pirates probably hated, you know, the last couple of years when they were the first team and they lost the last two. You know, if it had been in the old format, they would have had a better chance of playing a full postseason series. Now they're probably really big fans of it because it's the only thing really giving them, you know, good reason to believe that they can still be postseason team, because the Dodgers are gaining ground on the Giants and they've pretty well pulled ahead in the wild card, the first wild card race. And the Pirates are about to see those two teams, the Dodgers and the Giants, here in a row on this West Coast trip. So you're probably going to get a little bit of a better feel for how close they are to being a postseason caliber team by the way that they perform over this next stretch.
You mentioned
they did in the previous one.
Absolutely, and you mentioned that these big six games coming up on the West Coast against the Dodgers and against the Giants is going to answer a lot of questions coming up in the next week or so. Adam, with all this said, if Jameson Taillon continues to pitch the way he did on Thursday, if he does this every fifth day, then perhaps this playoff race will start to intensify and just have a different feel towards it. Taillon was great again. 8 scoreless innings against the Padres at PNC Park, and I think the baseball world is starting to awaken to what the Pirates have known for a couple of years now, that this kid Taillon can really be something special.
Yeah, you really can't say enough about how impressive he's been since he came up. It's the consistency, the strike throwing, the poise, you know, the fact that he's been so consistent over the last 6 starts or so. He's thrown at least 6 innings, all in quality starts. You know, now he's had 2 of his 10 major league starts within 8 scoreless innings. It's really, really, really impressive stuff from a guy who did not pitch in affiliated games over the last 2 years. I wrote about it last week, and you know, he was ready to kind of put the whole prospect thing behind him. He was ready to show that he could be, you know, a competitive major league pitcher. I think at this point you could argue that he's, you know, been maybe the Pirates' best pitcher over this recent stretch. He's certainly a very solid number two to Garrett Cole, if you want to, you know, if you still view Cole as the eighth of the staff, which I think he certainly can do given his track record, really an able replacement for the Francisco Liriano that the Pirates hoped they were going to get to start the season.
Yeah, no question. And when you go back to the start of the season and you look at the rotation then compared to the rotation now, I mean, it's almost completely different. You know, at that point, at the beginning of the year, guys like Taillon and Glasnow were the, you know, the young up-and-comers, but not quite yet ready to be a part of a major league staff. But now, like you said, you know, apologies to Garrett Cole, but Jameson Taillon is the best pitcher on this team right now. You look at the other new additions in Chad Kuhl and Ivan Nova through trade and a returning Ryan Vogelsong. And, you know, I got to give Neil Huntington a lot of credit because, you know, every team during the course of a season is going to have some attrition and go through changes in their rotation. But in my opinion, I don't think any team has been as aggressive in revamping and reformatting their rotation as the Pirates have. And I got to give Neil Huntington a lot of credit because it would be easy to not lay back, but kind of make excuses and say, you know what, we've been hit by this injury, this underperformance, and we just have to ride things out. That's not what he did. He knows this team is still in the thick of a playoff hunt, and this rotation as it stands now, you know, this could be something special for the Pirates going down the stretch because there's a lot of new faces, but they're all performing well.
Yeah, and something had to give at some point with the rotation. You mentioned that opening day group. It had Juan Ocasio, Francisco Liriano, Jonathan Neese, and Jeff Locke. They all put up ERAs over 5 as starters with the Pirates. That simply wasn't going to hold up. So they had to do something, and I think Neil Huntington was pretty aggressive. You know, the plan was always for Tyone to fall into the rotation at some point this season. And he has done that, and after a little bit of time down to, you know, make sure that he's fresh into September, he's really claimed spot as his own. There's no question he's not going anywhere. And then at the trade deadline, they were pretty aggressive to essentially replace Liriano with Ivan Nova. The Liriano trade wasn't all that popular in Pittsburgh. I think the Nova one very well could be. If he continues to pitch like he did in his debut, he'll get the ball tonight in Los Angeles. Ryan Vogelsong is just such a great story, and it's really made a whole lot better by the way that he's pitched his first few times out. The competition hasn't been all that great, you know, the Braves and the Padres, but the performance has been good. He's looked a little bit more like the good starter that he was in San Francisco than the kind of inconsistent reliever, and I think he is really taken to that role. And Chad Kuhl has actually done, you know, better than his stuff would indicate. He's really a competitive, kind of gritty guy, and I think if you start to see that power sinker come into play, you're looking at a pretty solid 1-5 rotation over the last, I think, 7 starts entering Friday night, basically since they bumped Jeff Locke and they kind of cut the cord from the open day rotation. They've got a 2.22 ERA. I don't know if that was the right number of twos when I said it, but 2.22 ERA in their last 7 starts. They've pitched more than 6 innings per start. It's really been the rotation that they need. They just can't get enough offense out of their lineup right now to back it up.